there any announcements today? I didn't see a sign up, so no announcements, right? Okay. So before I get started, I'm going to ask you these three questions pretty much for the next couple of weeks, just to make sure that you're actually doing what you're supposed to be doing. So here's my first question. Who's not in a group yet? Keep your hands up and keep them up. Okay? Look around. You've got an orphan group right here, right? Maybe after class would be a decent time to get together and become a group. You've got about 6 people. That'd make it work. If not, go and add your names to the orphan list. I've sent you the link. Just put your name down. Ask to be adopted. Make some sob story, how you grew up, you know, raised by wolves in Albania, and you made it all the way here, and this is the time you're... So whatever you need to do. So that's the first question. So there are about 10 people at least who put their hands up saying you're not in a group. Tougher question. How many of you have not picked a company yet? Okay. Work to do, okay? By this weekend, I'd like you to pick a company. Okay? Don't try to pick the perfect company. In fact, let me take a load off your shoulders. Let's say you pick a company. 3 weeks in, you don't like it. You can change it. And if you've done the work on this company, the way you work through a company will not change if you pick a new company. So just pick a company and move on. Okay. Third question. I know the bookstore is doing its usual foot dragging about the package. Has anybody been able to get a packet at the bookstore yet? No. Okay. So I've got to figure out a way to light a fire under them. Final question. I sent a link out to where the S&P Capital IQ is accessible. I know none of you have even tried, but if one of you has found it or finds it over the next couple of days, if you could go check. I think it's supposed to be in UC somewhere. No? If you find the terminal that allows you to... I'm sorry? It's in the EY. Okay. So if you can just send me the exact location, maybe take a picture, and because otherwise people say, I couldn't find it. I wandered around for 2 days. Okay. So I will send that out. Okay? So let's get started. Okay, let's get settled in. My wife is a first grade teacher, or used to be before she... No, stayed home. And she taught me a little trick, which is if people are talking louder, you talk softer and softer and softer because you keep raising your voice. Eventually, you're just screaming at each other. Nobody can hear a thing. So if you notice me just dropping my voice, it's because I'm hearing you more than I should be. So now I'm all settled. Okay, let's go back to where we were on Monday. What was the question we were trying to answer? If you're the stockholder in a company, how much power will you have in this company? And one of the devices we were using was looking at the top 17 stockholders in a company. We looked at Disney, we looked at Vale, we looked at Tata Motors. And with each one, we tried to come to a judgment. With Disney, I said, I'm powerless. Institutional investors have taken over the company. Incidentally, one final thing. Did you get the invitation I sent you from Yellow Dig? You know how many of you have actually accepted it? I'm getting really, really hurt. It's like 20 of you. There are like 250 people in the class. So accept the damn invitation. It's not a big deal. You don't even have to visit the site. I just like the number up there. Right? The reason I picked that is actually for the weekly challenges. It's a social media site. So when you get it should look very familiar to you guys because it's like Facebook. Okay? It's Facebook with a purpose. So you kind of get my view of what Facebook without a purpose looks like. It's just regular Facebook, right? So it's Facebook with a purpose, which means that you can post anything you want within financial reason. So this week, for instance, I posted the weekly puzzle, which is Larry Fink's letter that he sent out to... Larry Fink actually is the head of BlackRock. BlackRock is the largest fund manager in the world. They manage $4.2 trillion. Okay. And he sent out a letter to companies saying that they should be more long-term in their focus. One of the things we're going to talk about today. And I actually titled I should have titled the weekly puzzle, "People Who Live in Glass Houses Should Not Throw Stones." And BlackRock is the glass house, surrounded by boulders. And he's given us a big target. So go for it. Find anything you want related to the issue, and pretty much everything is. And go and post what you want on that's what you have to get registered first. That's why I want you to connect on to Yellow Day. So let's move on. The next company I want to look at is Baidu. Sometimes the answer is so obvious you don't even have to dig very far, right? So if I ask you, you're a stockholder in Baidu, how much power do you have in the company? Your answer is none. Well, that doesn't quite work in a report. If you say none, I want some backing. So let's see why none. First is, if you look at the board of directors, there are six directors at Baidu, and one of the directors is the founder CEO, Mr. Robin Li. He controls a big stake of the voting shares. They have 10 times the voting rights of the non-voting shares. He controls the voting shares. It gets even worse. Baidu has that shell corporation structure. So what you bought are shares in the shell company. And the main company is set up as what's called a variable interest entity. I have no idea why they even came up with this name. But it's questionable as to whether you or I as stockholders can ever change the way that entity is run. If you don't like the way the entity is run, you can sue. But you know where? In Chinese court. God help you. Okay? Because you're not, if the variable interest, and it's happened, there have been at least a half a dozen cases in the last 5 years where the variable interest entity said, we don't respect the agreement, we're going to do whatever you want, try to stop us. Okay? So file that away. Again, it's something that's going to come back to play when we look at Baidu as we go through this class. Which brings me to one final page. And this is actually Disney updated to 2009. So remember in 2003, 16 of the top 17 investors were institutions. Notice in 2009, one very big change. Who's on top of the list? How did Steve Jobs become the largest stockholder in Disney? Pixar. It was the Pixar. He owned Pixar. And when Disney bought Pixar, they paid in shares. I'm going to show you the 2013 holding page for Disney in a little while, maybe in three sessions. And guess who's going to be on that page, who's not on this one? Come on, you went to the Star Wars. You're going to see George Lucas show up, right? So every time Disney buys these big companies, along the way they're accumulating. Now let me ask you a question. Again, it's 2009, you're a stockholder in Disney. Now you're looking at this list. Remember in 2003, I said I looked at that list and my stomach dropped. There was nobody on that list who was going to ask tough questions. In 2009, I was still a stockholder in Disney. I looked at this list and I felt a little better. Why? It's not because I thought Steve Jobs would be watching out for me personally. But the biggest problem I see in the entertainment business is that these entertainment companies still think it's 1985. They think they produce movies, they release in movie theaters. 6 months later, they manage the streaming and the DVDs. And it's not 1985. The world is changing. And many of these companies don't seem to... You're saying, how's Steve Jobs going to make a difference? There are lots of things you can stay, you can critique Steve Jobs, but he was not a live and let live kind of guy. If he didn't like something, my guess is he pretty much spoke up. So I'm glad he's on the board, not because he's going to say, look, you know, do buybacks because it's good for stockholders, but because he's asking managers tough questions. And that's what I want you to start thinking about in terms of corporate governance. This is not about stopping top managers doing what they want. It's to make them explain why they do what they do. And if they have a really good reason, go for it. But that's the job of a good board. So start with this for your company, because in a sense, it's going to give you some perspective on who runs a company, where the power lies in your company. Let's move on to the second linkage. Remember I said that if you're a lender, you lend money to a company and you don't protect yourself, what happens to you in the utopian world? Nothing bad. Now let's get real. Let's play a game. You guys be the bank. You guys be the equity investors. I gave you the fun job here. You go to the bank to borrow money. So let's walk over. You go to the bank. How do you describe the projects you're going to take with the borrowed money? Safe projects or risky projects? Safe, really safe. In fact, I look after this money as if it were my own. Let's say you're a trusting banker, which is an oxymoron. And you say, oh, you look honest. Here I have $3 billion. So now the bankers lent you $3 billion with no strings attached. You told the banker You're going to take safe projects, but there's nothing contractual that binds you down. Do you see how once you have the money, your incentives can be very different? What are some of the things you can do with the cash? You're not contract. You can do whatever you want. You could take really risky projects. You say, how's that going to help me? We're going to talk about risk in a session or two. The essence of risk is you get big upside and big downside. But now that you borrowed the money to take the big risk, who gets the downside? The bank does. And if there's upside, you get to keep it. This is very Trumpian. It's a word I will throw into. Because that's an ocean of leverage. You lend money, I'm going to take far riskier projects than I described to you. And it's not their fault, it's your fault for not putting it in. What else can I do with the cash? Can I pay myself a dividend? Why not? Buy back stock. I can essentially take that cash and undercut everything I told you I would do. Which is part of the reason you don't get to be a trusting banker for very long. So when we look at stockholders and bondholders, stockholders being the equity investors and bondholders being the lenders, you have this potential for conflict, and if you don't protect yourself as a lender, you are going to get exploited. You think, what if I lend to somebody really reputable? That comes up sometimes, right? What if I lend to Coca-Cola? They wouldn't do this to me, right? I have what I call the Nabisco exception, in case you're ever tempted to lend to somebody who has a really good reputation. Let's say it's 30 years back, 1984. Most of you weren't born. None of you were born. But let's say you were born. You had retired. You moved to Florida, doesn't everybody? You live on a golf course. You have $500,000 in savings, and I'm your broker. So you come to my office and say, look, I've got to invest this money. It's all my entire life savings. I suggest a nice mutual fund. You say, no, that's too much risk. I can't invest in stocks. I suggest a T-bond. You look at the rate and say, oh, no, you know what? Not high enough. I need to pay my golf club fees. So I suggest a nice corporate bond. Initially, you're a little skeptical because corporations do default. And then I said, no, this corporation you probably heard of. It's RJR Nabisco. I said, I've seen their name all over the grocery store. They've been around a long time, right? Yeah, 70 years. And to make you feel even better, I tell you they have a AA rating. You have no idea what I'm talking about. So I tell you that no company with a AA rating has ever defaulted on its debt while it was AA rated. I'm a very careful broker. This is technically absolutely true. So you take your $500,000, you buy Nabisco bonds. You go back to the golf course. 4 years later, you come back from a game. You sit at the bar. You open up the Wall Street Journal. And there is this headline. It says, KKR does LBO of RJR. All these acronyms. You have no idea what they even mean. So you call me and say, what the heck happened here? Nothing technically, but this outfit from New York called KKR has borrowed a ton of money and bought out Nabisco. And you're saying, what does this mean for me? Well, again, technically nothing. You still own the same bonds you did yesterday. But remember that AA that I mentioned? They're still in the alphabet, but they've slid. What happened? You do an LBO. Your AA rating becomes a BB rating. You still own the same bond with the same coupon rate, but what are you more exposed to now? That you will not get paid. On the day of the Nabisco leverage buy, this is the day that on the headlines of KKR, the Wall Street Journal, was how much money the equity investors in Nabisco were making on that very same day. This is what your bond did. Your $500,000 just became $400,000. 20% of your savings is gone. And why? Because you were unprotected. Protected against what? They didn't leverage buy it. You had no recourse, right? You post-Nabisco, I'll talk about what companies started to do to protect themselves. But pre-Nabisco, when you bought corporate bonds, there were no covenants. Because people didn't expect big companies to do stuff like this. You live and learn. So that's the second stop. Lenders lend and they don't protect themselves. They're going to get ripped off. Let's move to the third link. Remember I said, oh yeah, go ahead. 1988 was leverage buyout. Let's move to the third link. What is the third link? Basically, I assume that managers reveal information to financial markets honestly and on time. Utopian world. And what do markets do? What is the trading room? Full of polite intellectuals who, when they got the news, would seriously assess the effect on cash flows and value. That's a utopian world. There are a few problems there. Let's start with the first one. Do managers always tell the truth? Maybe, maybe not. In fact, managers are human, in case you're wondering. They're not robots. Maybe they should be robots. They're human. And they have a very human tendency when it comes to telling the truth. I'm married. I've been married 28 years. And here's one of the little secrets to staying married 28 years. If I get some really bad news today, I'm not going to get home at 6:30, open the door, say, "Hon, I have some bad news." In fact, if I have some bad news, I try one of two strategies. One is a good time. Not now, not now. Window of opportunity closed. Maybe when she's sleeping, I'll whisper it to her. "I told you last night." "Oh, you were sleeping. I didn't realize that." I could try that. The other is I try to bundle the bad news with some good news. Hence the expression, I have some good news and bad news. Like, this morning on my way to the train station, I wrapped my car around a tree. Oh, but I switched to Geico. Completely disproportionate, but I'm hoping it'll cushion the impact a little bit. Companies do something similar. So when companies have bad news to release, they look for a good time. So just like your spouse is sleeping, they look for times when the market is sleeping. So when is the market sleeping? In fact, I'm going to show you the result of a study I did when I actually used to write these academic papers. I gave up on that about 20 years ago. What a waste of time that was. So this is one of those papers you write to get published. And I spent like 3 months of my life on this. So what I did was I collected every earnings announcement and dividend announcement made by U.S. companies. And I looked at what day of the week they came out in and looked to see what news they contained. So Monday announcements, Tuesday. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday all look pretty much the same. Then you get to Friday. Really bad things happen to companies on Friday. And then I took a look closer look at Friday. And it's actually not the course of the day, but 4:01, 4:02, 4:03 on Fridays. Horrible times. If you don't believe me, wait till this Friday. Wait. Now, so J.P. Morgan wants to reveal that some trader in London lost $7 billion. Comes out at 4:03 p.m. What are they hoping to do? They hope you'll forget by Monday morning. There's zero chance you will, but no harm hoping. And guess what? When you come in Monday morning, do you still remember the $7 billion loss? Yeah. Mondays are the worst day of the week to invest in. Every single year for the last 82 years in the U.S. equity markets, Mondays have been the worst day of the week to invest in. No surprise. So first is you try to delay the news till the right moment. Or they try to bundle the news with something good. Like what? "We lost $3 billion, but we're in China." That used to work until a year ago. "Or we lost $3 billion, but we've doubled our sales in Namibia from $1 to $2. So basically, you say, what? Take a look at earnings reports and how companies try to package bad news. Again, I don't blame them. It's human nature. Once in a while, they do cross the line, right? The line I'm crossing by talking about where they don't just try to manage the news, they try to manufacture it. They try to lie. And I'll give you a few examples. It's a company called Briex. I'm sure most of you haven't heard of it. It was a Canadian gold mining company, one of the most highly rated gold mining stocks on Wall Street for about a decade. And the basis for the entire company was they claimed to have found the largest gold reserve in the world in Indonesia. In fact, to convince equity research analysts that they had, they flew them out to Indonesia. They landed and they'd salted the earth with gold dust before the analysts said, "Look, there's so much gold under the ground, it's coming out." Let's face it, most gold mining analysts in New York have never seen a gold mine. They think gold comes in coins and ingots. So they come back and they write these glowing reports. "This company has found reserves so good, the gold's coming out of the ground." Stock price goes up and up and up. And in 1996, the geologist working for the company who supposedly found the gold mine jumps out of a plane at 32,000 feet without a parachute. Now, nothing good can happen to you when you do that. And nothing good happened to this guy. And people start asking, why did he do that? Was he depressed? And over the next few weeks, the company starts releasing these little news stories. It says, "Look, we told you there were 10 million ounces, it's really a million." Then the million became 100,000. Then finally they said there was no gold. The whole thing was a 10-year fraud. That is cross the line. Oh, here's another example. This is one of my favorite of all time. Wall Street Journal story, 1999. Company called Mercury Finance. It's a company that used to make loans to people with credit problems. It's a small business. Used to do well. And the news story says, Mercury Finance announces that they cannot find their CFO. He's disappeared. We've looked everywhere. We looked under his desk, in his apartment. He seems to have disappeared, and you keep reading the story. The company also said that half their cash balance is missing. Now, somebody's having a lot of fun somewhere, and it's not you and I as stockholders. That is outright fraud. So every year you read a few stories of fraud like that. But I still think they're the exception rather than the rule. At least in U.S. markets, what's much more common is errors of omission, things you hold back, or delayed information. It's not outright fraud. But let's face it, sometimes companies cross the line. Let's go to the other side. What do we say? Investors were cool and rational, right? Polite intellectuals in the trading room. Let's replace them with the savages that you usually see in a trading room. Have you ever seen a trading room in action when a news story hits? This is chaos. People buy, sell, do something, we'll talk about it later. Cool and rational won't come to mind. Polite and intellectual are not even in the conversation. Markets do a lot of crazy things. This is what gets called collectively behavioral finance, that people react to small news stories with big price changes, that they're short-term rather than long-term, and that's the basis for the Lawrence Fink letter, is maybe investors are, you know. We'll come back and see whether that's a fair judgment to make. But let's face it, a lot of people, I asked you right now, are investors short-term? Probably most of you reading the stories, of course they're short-term. They do crazy things. And of course there are a few conspiratorial people who believe that this is all fixed. By whom? I don't know, six people getting in a room in New York and decide the whole market. They're convinced that the reason they've lost money every year for the last 25 years is those six people. If they ever find them, they're going to shoot them. I mean, let's face it, even The Big Short makes it look like there's a conspiracy. I mean, I'm convinced. I mean, rather than think of bankers as these wicked, clever people, I really think of them as greedy, stupid people sometimes who get caught up in the greed of the moment. That's what drove The Big Short, not this notion of, hey, Goldman Sachs knew this crash. They had no idea it was coming. They were just as greedy as everybody else, and it hit them like everybody else. Of course, in the last few months, they tried to slip out of it as best as they could, as did every other investment bank. So there is this notion, at least, that investors are not cool and rational. And I agree, investors do some crazy things. But I really think that the kind of judgment that people pass about investors sometimes misses the point. Let's take this notion that investors are short-term, right? So let's see how much you agree with that statement. Let's see if, in fact, the evidence backs it up. So I'm going to read you three statements, and I want you to answer from the gut. There's no right answer here. So at the end, I'm not going to say A, B, and B are the right answers. This is from your gut. I want you to think about where you stand right now. The first is, focusing on market prices will lead companies towards short-term decisions at the expense of long-term value. So think about it for a moment, and if your answer is yes, just put down agree. If it's no, put down I disagree. Second, it follows from the first. Allowing managers to make decisions without having to worry about the effect on market prices will lead to better long-term decisions. So again, agree or disagree. Finally, neither managers nor markets are trustworthy. This is going one level up. That you actually have to write rules and laws that force firms to make long-term decisions. So that's actually one level above. I don't trust markets or managers should be left alone. This is, we have to pass laws that tell that every company has to pay out 20% of its earnings as dividends, that every company has to reinvest 50% of its earnings. So again, as I said, no right or wrong answer. File your answers away because I'm going to try to give you as much evidence as I can that might change the way you think about the world. Let's start with this notion that investors are short-term. What's it based on? It's usually based on seeing markets move a lot on small news stories, right? Earnings announcement comes out. Amazon loses 10% of its value or 15% of its value. That's $50 billion. Where did that go? Do you know that during the course of January of 2016, do you know how much market value was lost collectively across the globe? $5.54 trillion. Where did that go? In a sense, if you're a conspiratorial, you're convinced there's somebody out there who's collected the $5.54 trillion, put that in the pocket, and walked away. But it seems to have disappeared. So let's see if, in fact, the evidence backs up this notion that investors are short-term. Let me give you some counter-evidence first. If investors are short-term, how the heck do you explain the fact that Uber is valued at $62.5 billion? I mean, if they're short-term, they should be looking for earnings, right? How much money did Uber make last year? It lost huge amounts of money. If you see these guys, Uber and Lyft, fight it out. For every dollar they collect, they spend $3. Now, there might be some long-term plan. You might trust Travis to deliver the rest. But they lost a ton of money. And investors are willing to attach, what? $62.5 billion in value. Okay, so let's take this. How would you explain the fact that Square is valued at $9 billion? It's in the public markets. What does Square produce as revenues last year? Close to nothing. Their earnings were negative. So it's not as if in the private markets you get these high values. In fact, why is Uber priced at 62.5? Notice I didn't use the word valued. That's attaching too much weight to what investors do. Why is it priced at 62.5? Don't think too long. Your fidelity, you're investing in Uber at 62.5. Is it because you think it's worth more than 62.5? No. I'll give you my gut. You know why they invested at 62.5? Because they think Uber can go public in a few months at 100, and they want to collect the money. Why 100? Because the momentum seems to be carrying it there. So the public markets drive the private market. So it's not as if the private markets, people can be wildly optimistic in the public markets, they cannot. Investors, in fact, in the last few years, you can argue, have collectively put much higher values on young growth, money-losing companies than they should. In fact, the argument might be they're being too long-term. Do you see why? That they're looking at these companies where there's no potential for making money for 15 years, and they say, that's okay, it's worth $5 billion. So I don't see how you reconcile this with the notion that investors are short-term, they want the earnings now. And there's another piece of evidence that actually suggests that investors are actually okay with you investing money back into the business for future growth. And I'll tell you where it shows up. When a company makes a large capital expenditure, or worse still, an R&D expenditure, lead me through what happens. You invest $3 billion in R&D. With accounting standards being what they are for R&D right now, what happens to your earnings right away? R&D is an operating expense, so you invest $3 billion. That's a $3 billion drop in earnings, right? If you're a short-term investor, that should be horrible. You should be punishing these companies. Or you make a big capital expenditure. You get a big depreciation charge, lowers your earnings. You should be punishing those companies. And what you see instead is when companies make big investment decisions, joint ventures, R&D, you see actually the stock price go up. That's not consistent again. I can't prove that investors are long-term. But when people say investors are short-term, my response is show me. What is the evidence you're basing it on? And don't tell me that your gut tells you that they're short-term. Because I need something tangible to attach it to. In fact, I'll make a statement. I think the typical individual investor is a lot more long-term than the typical institutional investor, by far. Who was selling January 2016? It wasn't you and I as individual investors, with institutions. You know, in markets panic, who's selling first? It's institutions. Institutions like to point to individuals. Oh, those poor, naive investors. They're not the ones running for the exit doors the minute, you know, the fire alarm goes off. I think you should run for the exit doors, and that happens. Or a fake fire alarm goes off. So individual investors are much more long-term. And I'll make a further statement. I think the typical investor is a lot more long-term than the typical manager. And both managers and investors are a lot more long-term than some government bureaucrat telling you. So in a sense, if you're going to tell me investors are short-term and you're going to trust somebody else, tell me who it is that you point to that you think is going to make good long-term decisions. This is not a choice between the perfect and the imperfect. You're all imperfect. So the evidence at least suggests to me that investors are, in fact, much more long-term than we give them credit for. And that's why I said, when Lawrence Fink, head of BlackRock, talks to companies about being long-term, you know how hypocritical that is? He's an institutional investor. I'll wager BlackRock was with everybody else selling in January. And in the same breath, he's saying, oh, you should be long-term. Remember I gave you the story of Peyton Manning? Did we talk about Peyton Manning last session? And how he couldn't throw 500? Is the U.S., if you think about life cycles for companies, and the life cycles for countries, where would you put the U.S. and Western Europe in the life cycle of countries? It was a startup country 200 years ago. It was a growth country 100 years ago. Today it is? A mature, perhaps, and this is what we don't want to talk about in the current political season, maybe even a declining. And how should mature to declining economies behave? You should have less capex, more cash flow. So to me, the notion that we can somehow reverse age and say, let's go back to the way we used to be in the 1950s, will make us all feel better because that's more factories and more employment. But I think you might be fighting a long-term secular shift here of an economy going from mature to declining. Okay? So there might be, and we'll talk about buybacks. There are companies that shouldn't be buying back stock that are buying back. Most of the companies, you look at the list of top 20 companies that buy back stock, I look at every company in that list and thank God, thank God, thank God, thank God, thank God. Because every one of these companies, I look at what they'd have done instead, and it scares the heck out of me. Would you rather that Yahoo have bought back stock than bought Tumblr? I would. I mean, how much did they just write off on that Tumblr deal? You're saying that's unfair, it's an anecdotal evidence? That is something. So take a list of the top 20 buyback companies. You'd be amazed at how much, when you put them up, how much the buybacks actually make sense in those companies. Now, let's talk about crises. Every time there's a crisis, people say, okay, this is why I told you should never trust markets. So I remember walking into this room in January 2009. I knew exactly what was coming at me. This is after one of the worst crises in developed markets in 100 years, since the Great Depression. And people said, I told you, so you shouldn't trust markets. Okay, so what happened in the last quarter of 2008? Markets melted down. Why did they melt down? Because economies were crumbling underneath, and also you had this mortgage, you know, subprime stuff. And what was the sector that was most responsible for the 2008 meltdown? Banks and financial service companies. And what's the most regulated sector in the whole economy? Banks and financial service companies. So you're telling me we need more regulation. Why? Because the most regulated sector in the economy dragged us into a crisis? That makes no sense to me. So you're right, in every crisis we say, oh, the market's responsible. The market is there to react to what's going on. Of course it sometimes overreacts. But again, to blame the market for the 2008 crisis is absurd. The market was just reflecting the mistakes that had been made underneath. In fact, the question is, maybe you should have reacted even earlier. So when you look at much of the evidence presented, you shouldn't trust markets. Look beyond the surface. I'm not trying to talk you into saying you should trust markets. I'm saying markets are a lot more trustworthy than the alternative, which is what? Managers and somebody up there saying, I know what to do with the economy, where companies should be investing and where they should. So third stop, think about that. In fact, I know in finance we often get too caught up in this rationality assumption. And it makes me uncomfortable because you often have these economists and finance people creating these great models built on the presumption that investors are rational. And when somebody gets too carried away, I apply what's called the Elvis Presley test. You ready? I'm going to apply it on you first. How many of you think Elvis is still alive? Okay, you don't want to admit it. You're saying, I know he's alive. I read about it last week. Yeah. Okay, so good, you passed the first level. So you can relax now because the second test has nothing to do with you. If you're in USA Today, it's like a McDonald's version of a newspaper. You can read the whole paper in like 20 minutes. And every day in USA Today, they run a poll. And that's a lot of polls, 250 polls a year. So they run out of questions to ask. So they start asking questions like, do you like lettuce on your burger? 69% of Americans said yes. 23% said no, and 8% said, I don't know. Have you ever noticed, no matter what the poll is, there's a 7 to 8% floating percentage that doesn't know. Americans were asked, do you know your name? 93% of Americans said yes, 7% said I don't know. So in 1992, on the 15th anniversary of Elvis's death, so in case you're waiting for the next iTunes new song to come out from Elvis, he's dead. The 15th, see, they asked, do you think Elvis is still alive? This is 15 years. 71% of Americans said no. Thank God for small blessings. 22% of Americans said yes. Let's do some basic statistics. The population of the United States is about 300 million. 22% of 300 million is 66 million people walking around thinking Elvis is still alive. Remember that. Next time you feel this urge to promise managers, if you do this, your market price will do this. What are you thinking? There are 66 million people walking around thinking Elvis is still alive, and you want to predict how they will behave? I remember the day that Twitter went public. It went public at 45, and I valued at 18. So I get this call from the Wall Street Journal reporter saying, how do you explain the 45? And I said, I don't have to. I didn't pay it. I never feel the urge to explain what other people pay. So he said, what could be going on? I said, there are 66 million people walking around thinking Elvis is still alive. Maybe you should cross-check the people on Twitter stock with the people who think Elvis is still alive. This could explain a lot of crazy stuff out there. So this is something we're going to dance around all through the class. I'm going to say, if you do this, your value will go up. And part of you is going to say, should I ask him, will the price go up? And if you do, you're going to get the same answer every single time. There are 66 million people walking around thinking Elvis is still alive. I don't know what the price will do. All I can tell you is, if you do this, this is what I think the value will do. So third stop, you can already see the leakage. Now let's talk about social costs. I am absolutely flabbergasted at how much business school coursework has gotten refocused. I'm not sure whether I'm in a school of theology or a school of business anymore. Ethics 1, ethics 2, ethics 3, ethics 4. I mean, come on, if you don't know the difference between right and wrong at the age of 20, you're beyond redemption. No ethics class is going to make you. All it's going to tell you is, how can you do crooked stuff and make it look like okay stuff? And then you got CSR. You know, what the heck is that? First time I heard, what the heck is CSR? It said corporate social responsibility. I said, oh, okay, that sounds good. Sounds like something that I would listen to at church every Sunday. But this notion that companies should be socially conscious has now become part of the business curriculum. And it seems like anybody who argues against this is going to be tarred, feathered, and made Danny DeVito. I'm okay with that. He makes a lot of money, after all. So here's my counter to why I think this is actually the wrong way to go. Let's face it, there are social benefits and social costs, right? Let's take that off the table. Of course there are social benefits and social costs. If you take any company's annual report, including the one you pick, first thing I want you to look at is pick up the annual report and look at how many pages the company spends telling you how socially conscious they are. Half the annual report is, oh, look what we did, look what we did. We built a park, we did this. And I think it's almost a part of financial reporting now. So you see, what's wrong with that? We want companies to be social conscious. Okay. When I go into companies and they make this big deal about social consciousness, I ask them to put their money where their mouth is. So I'm going to put you to the test. Let's say you decide to play the game. And this is the social consciousness. Here are some of the issues you're going to run into. I'm going to sound like Donald Rumsfeld now. And if your mind gets too crowded up, just walk away. Sometimes we tend to think of good companies as doing good stuff and bad companies as creating social costs. And I talked about that hot dog stand guy creating social costs. But here's the reality. Lots of big social costs are created without the company even knowing it's creating it at the time that it's created. When asbestos was invented in the 40s and 50s, people thought it was a magical product. Why? Because construction workers were not carrying heavy stuff. This was light. It looked durable. They said, this is amazing. So John Manville produced asbestos to become a large market cap company. They didn't say, look, we want to create cancer in people. That's why we're producing asbestos. It was only after 20 years of exposure that we discovered that, you know. So sometimes you don't even realize you're creating. What if I told you that your iPhone is making you stupid? Your IQ is dropping 2 points every year. You don't even realize it. By the age of 55, you wake up with a zero IQ. So what the heck happened here? Hey? At least the good news is you can't go below zero. I think that's it. You hit a floor. You're going to sue Apple, right? But it's too late. First, you have no brain cells left. So you won't even be able to find a lawyer to sue for you. But what I'm saying is I think people say if you're a good person, you will not create social costs. That's not true. Often you create social costs without even recognizing it. Second, social costs are in the eyes of the beholder. You know what I mean by that? If I went around this room and said, what is the most important thing you think that companies should do socially? I wager we can get different answers. I'll tell you the one sure way. I've been married 28 years. I said one sure way for me to get divorced. All I have to do is one thing. Buy 1,000 shares of Monsanto. If my wife saw that in our portfolio tomorrow, I'm done. Why? Because she has this GMO thing that is, you know, beyond, I mean, I think GMOs, you know, I don't want that in my food. But she's not just don't want it. She is, it'll set her off. So if she were in a room, let's say she worked in a business, and there was a GMO component to what you were doing, the $60 billion project, she's going, no way. If you look at social consciousness rankings, there are different outfits that do it. It varies depending on who's doing the ranking. AFL-CIO, for instance, rank companies on social consciousness. Guess what they use? How well they treat their workers, how much they're paid, because that's the AFL-CIO's job. It's a labor union. Their focus is on that component. Greenpeace ranks companies. It's almost all environmental. Do you see where I'm going? You have six people around a table trying to make a decision. I bring social costs and put it on the table and say, bring social costs into the decision process. And each of you brings out your soul. What happens next? How do we decide what to do? And that, I think, becomes the problem. You almost get paralysis in decision making because if you bring social costs in and they start to overwhelm the decision process, the game is done. You can't make a decision. So I'm not saying you can't be socially conscious, but you cannot make this the front and center of your decision making because there is no end game. So as I said, I'd like to ask companies to put money behind. So if you open the Disney annual report, and Disney's actually ranked, I think, as the third highest ranked company in terms of corporate social responsibility. I think Johnson & Johnson's up there, Google's up there, Microsoft's up there, and Disney's up there. So I pick up the annual report, I open it up. So let's say you're all Disney managers. I'm going to put you to the test of how much you actually stand behind your own words. Ready? So here's the first thing I'm going to say, look, Disney's planning to open a store in a city. Let's make it Newark. You've been downtown Newark? The entire section's been. And so what Disney's going to do is they're going to open a store in downtown Newark. Why? Because they want to revitalize. So it's and let's make this as clean a choice as possible. So no dancing around public relations stuff, no dancing around I can turn the. So this is actually very stark. If you do this, you're going to lose $1 million a year. But you told me you were socially conscious, you create employment. So here's my first question. Would you open the store? Anybody here? Nobody would open the store? So all that thing in your annual report about how socially conscious you were, was just words? You're saying, but I'd open the store if I could use it to advertise in other parts of the country so other people buy more. This is not, that's not social consciousness, that's advertising. If you want to dance behind the PR, you know, if you want to use that as your defense, let's not talk about social consciousness. Just doing, and that to me is at the core of this hypocrisy called corporate social responsibility. Is companies like to use it as kind of a defense against, look, corporate, we're socially responsible. And in fact, what they want to do is use it as public relations, as advertising to get other people to buy other stuff. That is how we have to judge companies. We'll come back and talk about what to do about social, because I think you're right. We have to think about how society views you as a company. And we talk about the problems. If you get viewed as a corporate outlaw, you know who I'm talking about, right? So tobacco companies became corporate outlaws about 25 years ago. So once you become a corporate outlaw, I agree, it affects you, it affects your earnings, it affects your revenues, it affects your value. So you have to bring in some degree of social consciousness, but it's got to be in a way that's more than this fuzzy, oh, I'll be corporate, the CSR stuff that you see in a lot of companies. So when you bring it all together and you say, what can go wrong? Pretty much everything can go wrong. Stockholders have little control over managers, so managers put their interests over stockholder interests. Lenders lend money to the firm and they don't protect themselves, they get ripped off. It's a financial term. Okay? In fact, let's introduce the word Nabiscoed into the language as well. So if you lend money and you don't protect yourself, you're going to get Nabiscoed. Okay? Managers sometimes cook up information, they delay information, sometimes they commit outright fraud, and investors are not always rational and cool. And social costs and benefits bubble up under the surface all over the place. This is the world we live in, not that utopian world in which I started this process. So we have a problem. See what the problem is? In this world, if I ask you to go maximize stock prices, you can do lots of crazy things. In fact, every big scandal you see is some part of this framework breaking down, an accounting fraud. Or a huge social cost, an environmental cost, is this process breaking down. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to look at why this process breaks down and offer you some alternatives. And I'll give you my bias as to which one I'd like you to pick, but I'll offer you some alternatives. But here's where the world where our maximizing stock prices and objective is going to break down. If managerial self-interest wins, they put their interests over, you have a problem. If lenders are unprotected, you have a problem. If markets are not rational and cool and information is not flowing to markets, you have a problem. And if you have lots of social costs and social benefits, you have a problem. So I'll concede we have a problem. So the question is, what do we do about it? I'll give you three choices here. One is maybe we can pick a different corporate governance mechanism. You say, what are you talking about? In the mechanism I've described so far, who's responsible for keeping managers in line? Whose job is it? Stockholders, we have to vote. We have to try to do this. And maybe it's too much for us. Maybe we're asking stockholders to do something that they're not equipped to do. Maybe we can have somebody else discipline manager for us. And I'll give you a couple of alternatives that have developed over the last 100 years as counters to the stockholder-based system that I've just described. So I'll start with that. Maybe we can pick a different objective, like what? Maximize market share, maximize revenue growth. Maybe that'll work better than maximizing stock prices. We'll take a look at that. Or maybe we can go back to maximizing stock prices and build in some mechanisms to kind of counter the problems I listed on the last page. Now, I'll give you my bias. My bias is for you to go with the third option because everything I know in corporate finance is built off that. So if you decide to go with maximizing market share as your objective, I've got to rewrite all of corporate finance as I know it in the next weekend. That's going to be a little much, but I'm going to try. So let me give you, as best as I can, an unbiased perspective on the choices. So here's the first one. Maybe you can pick a different corporate governance system. If you go back to 1945, at the end of the Second World War, the Japanese and German economies were in complete shambles. There was no economy left in either country. And between 1945 and the mid-1980s, in true economic miracles, both countries built themselves up again. Germany to become the second largest economy and Japan to be the third largest economy. And they did it using a very different corporate governance system than the US did. In Japan, it was the kairutsu. For those of you not familiar with kairutsus, these are cross-holdings, companies that hold shares in each other. So you have 50 Japanese companies all bound together by stockholding. And here's the way it worked. If one of those 50 companies was badly managed and badly run, the remaining 49 companies' managers would get together and replace the manager of the 50th company. Stockholders had no role to play. The German system was similar. It was a cross-holding system with a bank in the middle. So Deutsche was the largest single stockholder in Daimler. Daimler was the largest single stockholder in Allianz. Allianz was the largest single stockholder in Deutsche. They all supposedly kept an eye on each other. I call these elitist systems. You see why? Because the underlying theme here is managers are smarter than the rest of us. They know more about this process. Let them do the dirty work. Why let stockholders even get involved? And by the mid-80s, a lot of people in the U.S. who believed that the Japanese model was a much better model than the U.S. model. I don't know whether you've heard of Michael Porter, Harvard Business School strategy guru. 1988, he wrote a book, and you can find the book if he's not put it out of print to prevent the embarrassment. And in the book, he said, U.S. companies need to be more like Japanese companies. We need to form karitsus. We need to have managers watch each. And it sounded good in 88, right? Because everybody wanted to be like the Japanese. And then you got to the 1990s, and you saw the downside of these systems. They were great at dealing with individual companies, which are badly managed. You know what they fail at? You have systematic problems. What are systematic problems? If lots of companies are doing something stupid, then this system breaks down. So I'll take the example of the Japanese companies again. 50 companies bound together. Let's assume that instead of one company doing stupid things, 49 of the 50 companies have made bad real estate loans, and one hasn't. So let me ask you a question. Who's going to replace whom? The one guy who did the right thing is going to replace the other 49? Or the 49 guys who've been doing the wrong thing are going to get and say, what's wrong with you? You're not a team player? Make some bad real estate loans, or we'll fire you. That's exactly what the Japanese banks did in 1992. In 1992, the Japanese and the U.S. banks had roughly the same amount of bad real estate loans in their portfolio. U.S. banks were forced to reveal them, forced to take the punishment, and they were able to move on. Japanese banks said, what bad real estate loans? They surrounded the wagons, released as little information as they could, and hoped the problem would go away. And 24 years later, they're still struggling with the problem. Elitist systems have a problem. You know what it is? Elitists. You know who elitists? These are the smartest kids in your class. They're the smartest kids in college. They're the smartest kids wherever they go. And then they become the smartest people making rules. And all their lives, they're used to being right. And then they make this big mistake. And they hate to say, I was wrong. Elitist systems take a long time to admit mistakes because elitists come with big egos. In Japan, the smartest people went to work for the Ministry of Finance. That's where you had decisions made about the Japanese economy. So these weren't dumb people. They just were smart people. But once they got into that hole of mistakes, they could not back away. So when you think about alternatives to the U.S. or the stockholder-based system, and you think about an elitist-based system, think through the costs. Right? And this actually brings us to China. So how would you characterize the Chinese corporate governance system? We already said, you and I as stockholders, how much power in Chinese companies? Zero. So where does the disciplining come in Chinese companies? It comes from the top down. Top where? Somewhere in Bay. I don't know, some mysterious six people may get together and say, that guy goes, that guy stays, that guy goes, that guy stays. Very bright people, I'm sure, in Beijing making decisions on corporate governance. And when times are good, like it was for the Japanese in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, it looks great, right? Everything's working. Everything is efficient. Why do you think corporations love to go to China? Because everything, the rules are clear and the rules get enforced and you're done. So the real test for the Chinese corporate governance system is what's happening right now. That's when you're going to see, does this, any system will work in the good times? The question is, how do you react to the bad times? And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I don't know. But the global economy actually rests on how the Chinese government deals with this crisis because it's used to a top-down system. So that's the first choice, is have some group of really bright people decide who runs companies. Let's look at the second choice. Maybe we can choose a different objective. Increase market share, increase revenue growth, increase earnings. And God help you if you hire a consultant because they come in with their own acronyms. My CFROI. Say, what's CFROI? Well, we'll tell you, but you need us back every month. This is the key to consulting, is create an acronym that nobody understands, that's proprietary, and tell them that if you're not there, they'll never know what it is. But it's a magic bullet, EVA, CFROI, whatever it is. But it's something that replaces market price. Why do we like it? Because it gives us something we can control. And again, I'd caution you, anytime you pick an intermediate objective, which is what this is, market share by itself is a dumb objective. Why? Would you want 100% market share of a market? Before you say yes, what do you need to ask me? At what price do I have to sell? What if you have to sell it below cost? You get 100% market share. Market share helps you only if you can use it to make money and make, you know, ultimately it's got to be connected to something of value. So if you focus on market share and it becomes the center of how you do business, you're going to do stupid things. I'll give you an example. In 1981, American Airlines got a new CEO, a guy called Robert Crandall. He came in, and I still remember his first press conference. He said, I'm going to make American the number one domestic U.S. airline. Number one domestic U.S. airline. Notice how he said, not the most profitable, but the number one domestic U.S. airline. By 1989, it succeeded. American was the number one domestic U.S. airline, but there were only two airlines in 1989 making money, and neither of them was called American. One was Alaska Air, because nobody else, I guess, wanted to fly to Fairbanks. The other was the very young Southwest. That time, you know what they flew? Dallas to Houston, Houston to Dallas, Dallas to Houston, Houston to Dallas. Very boring, but they made a lot of money. They said, well, I don't care about L.A. to New York. It was exact counter to a market share argument because they said, we don't care about market share. We're a business. We need to make money. How novel. 38 years after deregulation, airlines said, you want us to make money? It's not miles flown. It's not passengers. No. You have to make money. That's a basis for a business. But as long as market share drove the decision-making, that's all they cared about. And when I go to investment banks, when I give this example, they all laugh, those stupid airlines. So I ask, especially in the investment bank analyst training programs, I ask them whether they've seen a deal table yet. Have you guys seen deal tables? They kind of dominate how investment banks think about the world. So deal table lists the top 10 investment banks in terms of what? Deals done. Not good deals, bad deals, but deals done. So how do you get on top of the deal table? You find a big deal, you jump in. Doesn't have to be a good deal, who cares? It's a big deal. And that exactly is what's... And it's amazing how obsessed they get. Oh, Morgan Stanley beat us this year, we've got to beat them next year. Market share is just, once it takes over your thinking, it's going to dominate your decision process. So which brings me back to why I still stick with maximizing stock prices. Let me tell you why I'm not sticking with it. I'm not sticking with it because it's a perfect objective. It's a very imperfect one. My defense of maximizing stock prices, if you let it work through, market price mechanisms are the only self-correcting mechanisms. Let me explain. Let's take that first link. What did I say? Stockholders have very little power over managers. And what do managers do? They put their interests over stockholder interests. Now, if you're a stockholder, every time managers put their interests over yours, are you getting a little more pissed off? Then you get more pissed off. There's a piss-off threshold that managers hit. And when that happens, there's a blowback. And I'll talk about some of the blowbacks. The second is, I said, lenders lend money to the firm, and they don't protect themselves. They get ripped off. They get Nabisco. Now, when bond investors get Nabisco, get pissed off, yes. There might not be much they can do about the old bonds, but you know what they start doing? On the new bonds, they start building in special features to protect themselves. I'll talk about what happened post-Nabisco that investors took to the market. Third, I talked about companies lying and holding back information. Does the truth eventually come out? Don't even think about it. It does, at some point in time. And when the truth does come out, what happens to the stock price? It not just collapses, it stays down. Why? Because you've lost all credibility. You can tell me all your growth plans in the future and say, I don't believe you. You've been lying to me for the last 15 years. To me, it's at the base problem at what Valeant faces right now. As a pharmaceutical company, they've lost all credibility. And if you create a lot of social costs, again, you hit this point where people start thinking of you as a corporate outlaw. And once that happens, you're a ripe target. For whom? For legislation, for taxes. People can pinpoint you, nobody comes to your protection. Those tobacco companies, just press more taxes. So let's take each of these counter reactions and work them through. Remember I said there's that piss off factor. You've pissed off the stockholders enough, they start looking to do something. Of course, with 1,000 shares, there's nothing I can do. Okay. But here are some of the things that start happening. Those institutional investors who just used to vote with their feet finally say, I can't do this anymore. The reason CalPERS became activists was not because they wanted to, but because they had to. I hope that this letter that Lawrence Finke sent out to companies is a precursor to BlackRock becoming more activist in its thinking. I'm not hopeful, but maybe that's what it is. So investors, at least a few institutional investors, become a little more activist, even if it means voting at meetings and telling you what they did. And if you really, really piss off investors, there are people waiting for you to hit the piss off threshold. And these are the people like Carl Icahn. You know what his biggest strength is? He can detect when stockholders are really pissed off at a company. He says, that's the company I'm going to target. Because here's what happens. Remember that proxy that came in the mail that I was ready to throw in the trash can? There are these services called proxy solicitation services that a Carl Icahn will hire. So the time the proxy gets on your, you get a call. They're almost like they're watching your mailbox. It's kind of a little creepy. You get the envelope and pick up the phone. Say, we just got the envelope, didn't you? How do you know? We know lots of things about you, so stay on the phone. Okay? And they say, look. And you say, what are you going to do with it? I'm going to throw it in the recycling. I said, don't do that. Just turn over your 1,000 votes. We'll do all the filling out for you. This is like, you know, you don't want to vote, and somebody comes up to say, you two, I'll vote for you. And normally we don't, that's not legal, but in the case of proxies, it's completely legal. You can turn your proxies over to Carl Icahn. You're saying, why are you doing this? Well, you're really pissed off, right? Anybody coming off the street saying, will you let me vote? Will you? No, you'll hand it over. Just vote against those guys. I hate them so much. It doesn't matter who it is that I'm going to give this to. That's activist investing. The typical target firm, finally, in a hostile acquisition. This is your ultimate blowback, right? Somebody tries to take over your firm. The typical target firm in an activist, in a hostile acquisition, is a badly managed, badly run firm where investors are really pissed off at the managers. So if you, as managers, keep pushing me and pushing me, there is that blowback that eventually happens. But for that to happen, I've got to allow activist investors to continue the market. I've got to have mechanisms like hostile acquisitions continue. And the reason I say that is, guess what politicians almost always want to ban? They want to ban hostile acquisitions, and they want to stop activist investors. Why? They're unruly people. They're crude people. The managers hang out in the right clubs with the... So, in a sense, you're stopping the mechanism that prevents that kind of adjustment process. So when you think about hostile acquisition, the next time you see a company targeting a hostile acquisition, take a closer look at the company before you feel sorry for it. And after you take a closer look, you're going to see why, in most cases, if you're the target of a hostile acquisition, you deserve to be the target of a hostile acquisition.
Aren't in a lot of cases, though, hostile acquirers just waiting for White Knight to come in?
You watch too many movies, I think. Okay. Let's face it. Let's first get. Do hostile acquirers do this with noble reasons? No. So what if White Knight's come in? In a sense, what's already happened? The White Knight comes in, is going to change the way the company. Why are we doing this? Because we want the company to be run differently, right? So what does it matter to me whether Carl Icahn does it or somebody else comes in and does it? The process of change is what comes out of this. And it's really not whether Icahn wins or Ackman wins, it's whether the change comes about anyway.
But yeah. If the new acquirer is management friendly, then what's the point?
Well, in that case, let the new acquirers, they pay the higher price, they bought your shares, right? So you're no longer even a party to this process.
But that doesn't actually help the rest of the
world. It doesn't matter. All you care about is you. Don't worry about the rest of the world. Right? So if White Knight comes in and you feel they're going to continue doing the bad things that the old guys did, what should you do? Sell your shares to the White Knight, say bye-bye, and move on. You say, what about those poor other people? Nobody held a gun to their head saying you have to stay in the firm. This is why when people complain about buybacks happening at too high a price, I'm saying, are you stupid? If a buyback is at too high a price, what should you do? And you're a stockholder in a company. Sell the damn shares. Don't complain that the buyback price is too high and sit around whining about it for the next 5 years. There's a very simple solution to some problems, and it comes from the fact that if you have a complaint, act on it. So I agree with you. You can have white knights, you can have all kinds of things, but as a stockholder, at least you've given me an opening to get out of this company that I've been trapped in for the last 5 years with bad management at a higher price, because the white knight had to pay the premium. So that's why I invest. I invest to make money. So in the sense, if the company doesn't change, maybe somebody else will come in and try a hostile acquisition later on. So that's the stock market reaction to overreaching by management. Let's talk about, let's make this specific to Disney. Remember in 1997, Michael Eisner had created that rubber stamp board. He was emperor of the world. Let's back up. When Eisner came to Disney in 86, it was a wreck. He did some really good things at Disney. That's something to remember, is when you see a CEO kind of overreaching, it's not because they started off bad. They often started off as good CEOs. So he started off well, he built up power, he had this rubber stamp board. And in 97, he was able to do what he wanted. Why? Because he had a history, a decade where he'd done good things for the stockholders. Starting in 97, he started running into trouble. And it actually was triggered by a decision he made that changed the way Disney was constructed as a company. He bought Cap Cities ABC in 96. And he told stockholders, trust me, I know what I'm doing. And they trusted him. And it turned out that Cap Cities ABC dragged the company down. And between 97 and 2000, the stock lost almost half of its value. You know how difficult that was to do between 97 and 2000? It's the peak of the dot-com boom. Everybody else was quadrupling. You were halving your price. How the heck do you do this? Maybe they got their objective function mixed up. So maximize firm value. Maybe somebody said, it's minimize firm value. And AT&T, through the entire, that last part of the decade, AT&T and Disney were racing. I can get to zero first. No, you get to zero first. I'll get to zero first. A collection of stupid things after stupid things. And as a Disney stockholder, you're getting pissed off and more pissed off and more pissed off and more pissed off. And the reaction Disney had was it kept moving its annual meeting to smaller and smaller venues. I'm convinced if this process continued, the next Disney meeting would have been at a Kansas City restroom where only Eisner could fit in the restroom. No room, just me. And it started manifesting in lots of different ways. In 2003, two directors resigned. And one of them was called Roy Disney. Remember him? He was the only individual on the 2003 list. And of course, he has a name. And what made it particularly damaging is why they resigned. They said, Michael Eisner is too autocratic. Why it took them this long to find that out, I don't know. But they resigned. And in 2004, Comcast made one of the most insulting acquisition bids of all time. And here's why. When you normally try to acquire another company, what do? You take the market price and you offer a premium. Comcast took the market price and offered a discount. They said, it was really never meant to be a hostile acquisition. It was really a spit in Disney's face. Look, your stockholders hate you so much, they will sell the stock for less than it's trading for. It didn't quite work, but the damage, in a sense, got done. Finally, in 2005, the board that Eisner had picked finally said, hey, you're so unpopular, we can't even hang around you. You got to go. And he did leave. He was replaced by a guy called Bob Iger, who's still the CEO. And he was the anti-Eisner. It's just like politics. You often elect somebody who's the exact opposite of the previous guy. He's the anti-Eisner. He came in, no ego, creates a board that's very open. Does things. In fact, Disney starts rising up the corporate governance ranks. Sometime, in fact, I forgot to tell you, Eisner initially tried to stop this process by juggling his board and putting in some corporate governance rules to make it look like he was listening. But you have a history of 20 years of not caring. People see through that very well. So when Iger came in, he came in and he changed the board, made it a much smaller, more independent board. And he changed the way the company was run. It was much more open with stockholders, was listening. But here's, the part that's a little troublesome. When Iger came in and he did all these things, he initially pushed Disney up the corporate governance ranks in terms of being able to listen to stockholders. People thought more. And in 2011, Iger actually did something very unusual for a CEO. He said, look, I want to create a succession plan so that somebody will come in and run the company. This is not about me. This is about Disney as a company. That's good, right? So he says, I'm going to step down in 2013 and have somebody else become CEO. And here's where the story gets a little tricky. In 2012, the board went to Iger and said, you really can't step down. You're too important for the company. Without you, there is no company. And he said, no, I'm not that important. So 2 weeks later, you can't step down. You're too important. No, I'm not that important. Have you ever seen Julius Caesar, the Shakespeare version? First time they offered to make him king. He said, no, I'm not king. Second time, no. Third time, okay, I'll take the crown. No, not a big deal. Put it on my head. I'm now king. Same thing happened here. Third time he was asking, so you're right, I'm so important. I should stay on. And then he started doing things to the board that Eisner did with his board, creating more of a rubber. You see where I'm going? The longer a CEO stays in place, the more you're going to see all the pieces come together for an imperial CEO. So what's the solution? How many terms is the president allowed to serve in the United States? Two. Why do we have that? 8 years, it's time to go. Maybe we need something like that with CEOs. Maybe there's got to be a clock, a 10-year clock that kicks in. 8 years, 10 years, you're done, you have to move on. Because the longer CEOs stay in, the more it looks like they become power centers and everything embodies what they do. Final piece. About 15 years ago, after a series of scandals in the U.S., Sarbanes-Oxley was passed. It's this huge, it's a 1,500-page document on how to improve corporate governance. All these laws and rules. And the only people who've been enriched by Sarbanes-Oxley are all those lawyers who have to read all the rules and tell you what you can and cannot do. But the original intent was a noble one, which is they wanted to improve corporate governance by passing laws that required good corporate governance. Let me give you the analogy again. I'd like Congress next month to pass a law that you should have good democracy. It should have informed voters. It'd be so easy. Informed voters, good democracy. What exactly does that mean? You can't legislate corporate governance. You can try. You can pass laws and rules. But if you make this all about laws and rules, you're missing the point. You will get a board that meets all the rules. And this is why I said early in this process that the Lehman board met the Sarbanes-Oxley rules but didn't do its job. I think we need to start thinking. This is something that's not done right now. When we think about corporate governance, and this is the question I need you to ask when you look at your company, look at your board, is rather than look at all the surface levels, how many insiders, how many outsiders, how independent the board, what's the score they get? I want you to ask a much more fundamental question. Is this the type of board that will say no to the top manager? You say, how do I come up with a quantity? This is with your guts. I'll tell you, I look at the Baidu board. These guys are not going to stop. I look at Jack Ma's board, no way. I look at the News Corp board. We say, why do we even have a board? Let Rupert Murdoch do whatever he wants. I mean, it's amazing how many companies look at the board and say, these guys are not going to say no to the top manager. That, to me, is at the core of the corporate governance problem, is we become so caught up in checklists. Independent board, 7 directors have to be, all kinds of meaningless distractions that we've lost sight of what corporate governance is supposed to be. Final point for on the corporate governance issue. If you ask me, if I make myself better governed as a corporation, will I have a higher value as a company? I can offer very indirect evidence on this. For the last 20 years in the U.S., you have these corporate governance scores that people have come up with. High scores mean you're better governed, and of course, it's based on checklists. But there are studies that have actually started looking at the relationship between corporate governance scores and stock prices. And roughly speaking, here's what they find. They find that for every 1 point improvement in corporate governance scores, the stock prices go up by about 8.5%. The returns you make over and above what you need to make is about 8.5%. So if you can improve corporate governance, your stocks deliver a much higher return. You trade at a much higher multiple of earnings. But to me, the core of corporate governance is, if you take a look at almost every company that gets caught up in a big scandal, you know what they all share in common? They're from different businesses, young, old. The one thing that they all share in common is they all have horrible corporate governance. You read the New York Times article today about Theranos? You don't read the New York Times, do you? There's actually an article, take a look at it, about David Boies. Know who he is? He's a leading one of the country's leading lawyers. And he's actually Theranos' lawyer because they're being sued all over the place. You say, so what? They need a lawyer. He also happens to be one of the... Remember the board I showed you last? I think they all died. Or at least they're all gone. I don't know what happened to them. But the board's changed. They now have only 6 members. But one of them happens to be David Boyce. That's... I mean, how do you become director of a board and also lead lawyer for the company? Scandal waiting to happen. So take a look, if you don't believe me, at companies that get into big scandals, and almost always at the core, you're going to find a corporate governance problem. Yep.
So how else do you ensure that questions?
Okay, that's actually a very good question. How else do you ensure that you have a board that will ask questions? How do you ensure that you have a good democracy? You have to get informed. And who's you? Voters have to do it. See where I'm turning? If we want good corporate systems, what do we need to do as shareholders? Start behaving like owners. And that goes from the top to the bottom, from the BlackRocks to the small investors. We need to inform ourselves and ask tough questions, because otherwise, no matter what's done, we're always going to have bad corporate governance. So I will see you next week.
So when people say, U.S. companies need to be one of the growing companies in the U.S. more, I think the problem is it's a very status quo oriented system. It's a system that protects the status quo. It's very difficult to shake out the status quo because capitalists have it themselves. And it used to be even worse.
Professor,
yeah.
I'm not convinced.
Right.
For multiple reasons.
Yeah.
Simply because last year, 2015, was the first time venture capital investments in Europe were higher than the US, first time in history. And on the other hand, like, they reinvest a lot. And on the other
but
hand,
where are we starting from? So if you're venture capital going in, the exit is always. So the venture capital can go in, but the exit has to be the public.
It has to be IPO.
So basically, that's the number to check. And without the IPO, so you'll get